Thanks, Alex. Because we have a little more time, having just the two principal speakers, we'll have a slightly extended commentary this morning. And it will be given by Ronan Steinberg, who teaches in the Department of History at Michigan State University. And before that, he held research fellowships at the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan and also at the University of Texas at Austin. His primary interest is in the impact of the terror, and particularly in the legacy of revolutionary violence, so he's well qualified to comment on our two papers. He's interested in the period, in fact, right through from the second half of the 1790s through to the 1830s, and he has several publications on that subject. Most recently, the nicely alliterative Retribution, Redress, Redress and Remembrance in Post-Revolutionary France in the Oxford Handbook of the French Revolution. He's also worked on revolutionary justice, and he has a book in preparation entitled, provisionally, presumably, The Afterlives of the Terror, dealing with the legacies of mass violence in post-revolutionary France. So, commentary from Ronan Steinberg.
Thanks. Thank you. We're okay here? All right. I want to thank Alex for organizing the panel and for letting me be part of it. And I want to thank Colin and David for stepping up and saving it from its many misfortunes. One of the misfortunes is that I fell victim to a violent strep in the beginning of this week. So I've prepared everything here in case my throat gives out, all the cough drops and everything, but I apologize in advance. I think we'll be okay. Might be a bit of a cough attack in the middle. So yes, like David said, usually the job of a commentator is to pull the papers together and some maybe recap their arguments and then give a few points to each paper. But since we all stepped up and made more extensive efforts, I will talk about the papers, but I'm also, they told me I can talk more. I'm a professor of history. If they tell me I can talk more, I talk more. So I took the opportunity to perhaps use this platform to offer some broader thoughts about the category of victim in revolutionary historiography, the difficulties of talking about it, and stuff like that. Now, at the end of year two, Robert Landais, a member of the revamped Committee of Public Safety, delivered a report in the name of the revolutionary government. This is a few months after the fall of Robespierre. The purpose of the report was to survey the state of France at that particular moment and to kind of chart its path for the future, kind of agenda for the Thermidorian reaction. Among the many issues raised in the report, Landais discussed the question of responsibility for the terror. Responsibility for the terror, he argued, was collective, part of a revolutionary dynamic that no one could fully control or understand. It follows that there was no place to bring individuals to justice for their role in the repression of year two. In fact, it was dangerous to do so. And here's the quote. "The revolution has left victims in its wake. Fortunes have been overturned. Are you now going to undertake the examination of each specific case? Reason, the welfare of the fatherland, forbids you from looking back at the ruins you have left behind." End quote. Revolutions, Landais was implying, cannot afford an accounting of their own past. Like Lot's wife, they risk turning into a pillar of salt if they look back at the smoldering city behind them. The gaze of the revolutionaries must remain fixed resolutely on the future, on the realization of the social and political order that they set out to achieve. But what is to be done about the victims? See, victims are all about an accounting of the past. What they want is some form of reparation, some restoration of things to where they were before the damage had been done. They are hurt, their lives have been rent, and they want to be made whole again. The demand of the victims, impossible yet inevitable, is to undo the past in some way. We have today two papers that each in its own way place the category of the victims at the center of their interpretation. Colin Jones's paper reevaluates Nain Thermidor by analyzing Robespierre's self-fashioning as a victim. Jones shows us that Robespierre did this intentionally, skillfully, and well before the terror. Devoting special attention to the last speech, the one of 8 Thermidor, Jones argues that we have here not so much the end of the terror, but rather a prefiguring of some of the more salient features of the Thermidorian reaction. Most notably a victim's culture or a culture of victimhood, something like that. So Jones's paper in this sense joins recent efforts, a tendency to stress the continuities across the divide of Nain Thermidor. Colin is part of a forum that Laura Mason edited for French Historical Studies on Thermidor. I also have a piece there, and I think a lot of the authors there stress continuities across Nain Thermidor. Alex Fairfax Cholmley's paper, sorry if I'm mispronouncing this, Alex, offers a social history of victims of the terror based on petitions that they wrote after the fall of Robespierre. Through this unique set of sources, and I think we must acknowledge at the outset the very evocative kind of emotional and enticing nature of the evidence you're dealing with. When I read your paper, I really felt that I was getting a glimpse into a lost reality, in a way, with this evidence that you brought forth. So Fairfax restores agency to the most agencyless category of all, the victim. For the victims of the terror, Fairfax shows, were not passive. They campaigned for the rehabilitation of their reputation. They demanded to be compensated for the losses they incurred. They denounced the authors of their misfortune, and they even wrote their own histories of that tumultuous year. So Alex's paper thus adds considerable depth to Bronislav Bachko's agenda-setting work about the reaction. Now, discussions of victims in the historiography of the revolution, even when it comes to the terror, are quite rare. It's difficult to talk about victims in the context of this historiography. First of all, who are they? Defining the victims of the revolution, defining the victims of any historical event that includes massive repression and massive social dislocation is a moral and political minefield. If you start kind of thinking about it, who are we talking? The royal family, the nobility, the church, people who were executed, their families, anybody who saw anything terrible, anybody who was scared that the National Guard will knock on their doors. The category of victim has this kind of infinitely expansive, elastic quality to it, which makes it a bit tricky to work with. Moreover, there's another difficulty of talking about victims. If there are victims, there must have been a crime, or a disaster, or a catastrophe of some sorts. So are we now saying the revolution is a crime, or a catastrophe, or a disaster of some sorts? I know even historians highly critical of the revolution don't say that, won't say that, but the implication is there. And so I think there's a political problem in bringing up the victims of the revolution, or victims of the terror, that's difficult to contend with. So the presenters are to be congratulated for bringing up this subject directly, because as I think Alex shows very clearly, if you do so, you get new vistas on the revolutionary decade, things that we simply could not see before. What I'd like to do now is offer a few points for each paper and then raise some broader points on the category of the victim. So first for Colin's paper, my first question is about the rhetoric of victimhood that Robespierre employed skillfully. Why did he do it? I mean, what did he get out of it? Since it is a calculated move. So that's one question. In my second question, I might be answering a little bit my first one, I now realize. Anyway, but so. I just looked at it and I said, yeah, well, he could just say that. This issue of making claims on the body politic from the subject position of a victim, right? The realization that it confers certain benefits because it kind of places one beyond reproach in a way, right? As this figure of absolute innocence. Now, was this a new feature that was introduced by the revolution into political life? Because if it was, I think that's a fascinating hypothesis to examine. Is this something that emerges under the French Revolution Or is this, does this have a longer history under the monarchy, for example? It would be interesting to see. I always, my point of comparison when I think about mass violence is always to think, well, how did victims of, let's say, something like St. Bartholomew's Massacre position themselves in its aftermath? I know there's a problem with available sources. I bet it would have been very different. Maybe because of the presence of the religious framework in place. So that's another thing. Third point that occurred to me while reading your paper, Colin, I might be reading into it. It seems to me that your interpretation challenges a very influential thesis of Keith Baker, right? Keith Baker's kind of influential argument that the origins of the revolution and the origins of the terror lie in this discourse of the will, right? So just as a quick reminder, right, Baker argued that in the ideological origins of the revolution, he argued that there were three competing discourses that developed under the monarchy in order to critique the monarchy, right? There was a discourse of reason, a discourse of will, and a discourse of justice. And what happens in 1789, Baker thinks, is that the discourse of will, the Rousseauian one, gains the upper hand. And that makes the terror inevitable for him. But in this rhetoric of victimhood that Robespierre is undertaking well before the terror, that's a discourse of justice. It belongs to the, in many ways, to a rhetoric of justice. So I wonder if there's a nice way of actually complicating this very influential thesis of Keith Baker here. Another small point that occurred to me while listening to you now, this issue about depicting Robespierre, this vituperation, depicting him as Nero, as Cromwell, as Catalina, that's something that repeats itself in characterizations of représentant en mission in general after. And I think that it could be, I know it's a delegitimizing tool, but I think it is also a discourse on the nature of power, on the nature of political power under the revolution, and they refer to antiquity in order to. Anyway, my final point is actually a counterfactual one, and it's to, if I may raise a counterfactual point, and it's about this continuity that I think you see across nine Thermidor. You said that the Thermidorians achieved much of what Robespierre lays out, this plan, this political plan of his. Yes, but they also dismantled very rapidly the institutional apparatus of the terror within weeks after his fall. You know, they repealed laws, they released the mass release of prisoners, etc. They reorganized the Revolutionary Tribunal in a way that curtailed much of its power. So is there any reason to believe any of this would have taken place if Robespierre were still in power, any of this dismantling? And if so, doesn't this suggest that we are still dealing with quite a radical turning point in Nine Thermidor? That's the counterfactual. Moving on to Alex's paper, So I think that one of the profound questions, and there are many, one of the profound questions that Alex raises in his paper is this about rehabilitation of reputation. Why did they need to do that? Why was that important for the victims of the terror to rehabilitate their reputation? And I'd like to offer some thoughts about this because, you know, I work with similar materials, so I've encountered that a lot myself. I've written about the réhabilitation de la mémoire as the phase, the posthumous exoneration. I've written a lot in my other work, Beyond Revolutionary Historiography, right? I write a lot about genocide, right? And in victims of genocide or other such events, you never find this quest for self-rehabilitation afterward. But you do find it after the reign of, you find quest for compensation and other forms of redress, but not for rehabilitating the reputation. That's not something that concerns victims in aftermath of genocide, stuff like that. But in the case of the terror, it does, and in the case of the Soviet terror, it does. It's an interesting comparison. There's a massive campaign to rehabilitate victims of Stalinist terror after the death of Stalin, those who are released from the gulags. And it's interesting that it's in the revolutionary context where that takes place. So I wonder if part of it has to do with the fact that these are people who are, have been targeted by a legal procedure. Whether we think it's an appropriate legal procedure or not doesn't matter, but the legal procedure. And so they are they're kind of tainted by that, right? By the status of a criminal. There's a certain civil death quality to it that goes with that. And I wonder if that's a significant thing. I also wonder if there's a social class dimension to this, because I don't think it was important equally for all people to rehabilitate their reputation. It was important for people of means. It certainly was important for noble characters, for noble victims from families of the nobility. But I came across a lot of petitions of victims who were illiterate from the lower, you know, they signed with an X. Somebody else wrote it for them. They signed with an X. They only want one thing. They want the property back. That's the only thing they're worried about, right? They might say, you know, I'm innocent, whatever, but they don't care what you think. You know, they just want the property back. So I wonder if there's a social class dimension to this. Regarding the denunciations, I'm struck by how continuous they are, actually, with the practice of denunciation under the terror, right? A widespread, not just the terror, but you know, from the earliest days of the revolutions. Colin Lucas has written about this. Jacques Guillaumeau has written about this. And Antoine Dubec called it a kind of spectacle of transparency that they try to establish for these denunciations. So the interesting thing, if that is true, is are these victims actually taking part in a quintessentially revolutionary practice, maybe without realizing, without knowing that they're doing that? Finally, I wanted to say something about the nature of the sources, particularly when it comes to these histories, these alternative histories of the revolution. First of all, I should call your attention, because you posed a lot this contrast between, I suppose, official narrative created at the center and the alternative histories at the more popular level. But the National Convention itself, Anne Thomido, published at public expense a lot of these pièces justificatives. It comes from the center many times. So you see, they it's of its own of their own members. But for example, one of them, the case of Gustave de Chézeau, was kind of affiliated with the Girondins, and he was executed. And they ordered that his wife, you know, they published 260 pages of pièces justificatives at the Imprimerie Nationale, you know, at public expense. We also talked about this law that the convention took to fund an archivist who will preserve the material of the revolutionary tribunals for the benefit of the victims. So I think, I'm not sure there is that much, there is the contrast. I wonder how much that contrast is actually there. And also, Suzanne Dessane has worked a lot with petitions on another case, on issues of divorce and law and that from the Thermidorian reaction. And she read all the stories in them, but she also pointed out that these are texts written for a particular objective, to get something out of someone, right? So they are in a particular genre, they use particular languages, legalese or whatever it is that they're using, and so they have to be read also in that way, not just as an alternative history. I want to offer now some more general reflections on the category of victim. The first thing that strikes me is how the very category of victim is in tension with basic traits of the revolutionary worldview. Let me explain what I mean. The revolution is in many ways, right, in classic interpretations, and I think most of us still hold this interpretation, kind of puts the people as subjects on the stage of history, right, as agents on the stage of history, right? Transforms people into agents of their own destiny. They act through their own will on the world. They change it. Yet the victim is the exact opposite. Victims are passive by definition, because whatever happened to them, was done to them, not by them. So that's a one tension. The victim is the opposite of the virtuous citizen. The virtuous citizen is the master of his or her own fate. The victim is not. So there's an immediate opposition there. Also, as I've already noted when talking about Landais's speech, the beginning of my comments, there's a fundamental clash of temporalities between the victim and the figure of the revolutionary citizen. The revolutionary citizen looks forward to the future, to the realization, the goals of the revolution. The victim looks backward. So there's an inherent tension here, and I wonder if that's part of the difficulty of talking about victims in the context of revolutionary historiography. Speaking about temporalities, I think that writing about victims presents interesting difficulties for historians, because victims are the bearers of a past that does not pass, or that has not passed. Whether one uses the language of trauma, you know, modern, or of haunting, more ancient figure of trauma, for victims, a certain part of their past always threatens to kind of rear its ugly head in the middle of their present. Now the question is, what do we as historians who are trained in thinking about time kind of as past, you know, linear past, that's how we construct our narratives, right? Past, present, future. What do we do with this disruption of linear temporality that the victims present? How do we write about them? I think this is related to the problem of writing about aftermaths in general. See, writing about aftermaths, I wonder if Alex, particularly if you encountered that also, it's the opposite of common historical logic. So normally, how do we construct explanations, I think, as historians, right? There's something we want to explain. And that something is at the end of our chronological arc, usually, right? We want to explain the Russian Revolution. So we go back in time to 1880 or to 1450, doesn't matter, but we go back in time and we construct our narrative forward, leading towards an end point in time, which is the thing to be explained. But aftermath, writing about aftermath, is the exact opposite. You start with something, and then you hurl kind of into, I imagine the common historical narrative shaped like a cone, from a very broad thing leading towards the thing to be explained in the end. Aftermaths are the exact opposite. It's not clear what we're trying to explain, actually, where the explanation is leading. And I wonder whether writing about aftermaths and victims calls for a different mode of historical writing, one that is perhaps phenomenological, descriptive of some sort, something like that. That was my second general comment. My third general comment, I want to call your attention to the 1798 Dictionnaire de l'Académie Française, how it defined victim. According to the dictionnaire, a victim is, quote, a victim is A. There's a couple of definitions. A, in ancient religious laws, the animals that are sacrificed to the gods as offerings of appeasement or expiation. And B, someone whose interests have been compromised or sacrificed, someone who has suffered unjustly. So the victim is a category that traverses the theological and the juridical domains, right? In the theological sense, the victim stands at the center of a sacrifice, a ritual of transformation from the profane to the sacred, from a lower to a higher plane of existence. That's how the Durkheimians, at least, define sacrifice. He's a sacred figure, the victim, in many ways. In the juridic order, the figure that makes possible the transformation from the profane into the sacred. In the juridical sense, the victim is the one to whom justice is owed, the figure of innocence, and giving him back, him or her, the justice that is owed will restore a certain moral equilibrium that's been upset by the damage, by the injury. So in both cases, the victim is a figure of transformation, even of a certain creation, of something new. So what I'm suggesting is that we think about the victims of the revolution as fundamental elements in the institution of a new social order in the revolution. And I'm going to resort for a minute to Hebrew here. Don't worry, I won't speak in Hebrew, but I will make a point. The word for victim in Hebrew, korban, comes from the root karev, which means to be close, closeness. It's the same root for the word korvim, which is relatives. So victim and relatives come from the same root in Hebrew. The victim is that which brings together, you know, or around which something is formed. I know it's a very René Girard kind of theory that I'm advancing here, but I wonder if the victim is in fact a necessary element in this kind of institution of a new social order. And as my final point of general reflection, I'd like us to think about, all these things I want us all to think about together. Why is it that people like Alex, like myself, why are we actually interested in victims of the terror now, at this moment in time? Why are we interested in the aftermath of the terror now? Now, I think this reflects a certain zeitgeist, right, for lack of a better word. And I mean the preoccupation with past wrongs, with historical injustices, and with trauma. John Torpy, the sociologist, wrote that the concern in contemporary intellectual and political life with coming to terms with the past has become an obsession, or something pervasive. Also, Didier Fassin and Richard Reckman recently wrote that trauma has become, for better or worse, one of the dominant modes of relating to our past. Whether they're right or not, they're making these big claims. It would be interesting to think about how we have reached that this state of affairs, and I think it kind of, the 1970s is the turning point here, and I have certain ideas about why. But I want to point out here, to go back to the two papers, I want to oppose them in the tone that they take toward this interest in victims or victimhood. I think in Collins' paper, if I detect, there is a kind of a critical or a suspicious tone of this culture of victimhood, right? I mean, if I quote from your paper, look how you wrote about self-interest, nothing very flattering with all the, you know, in all this posturing of Robespierre. I think that Alex is far more respectful, takes the victims seriously in a way. So maybe there's also already a difference of generation. We already grew up and became formed as historians under different zeitgeists here. I guess I wonder if the presenters could address this difference in tone with respect to the victims in their papers, if I'm right. And for me, I must admit, the main thing here is to try and pick a fight between an advisor and his former student. I think that would be an excellent way to end my comments. Thank you very much. Thank you.
We got past that. That was a pass.